I'm greatly relieved to see this fantastic meeting here taking place in Germany on computational neuroscience. My first ever meeting was in 1980, before many of you were born. I attended the Deutsche Neurobiologentagung in Göttingen, and I was the only modeler they'd ever seen. They had a discussion whether it was legitimate to have a poster on modeling dendritic spines. And so finally, they put me at the end of the hall next to the bathroom. And two people came by. One came by to see the poster. The second one, he was looking for the bathroom. But he stayed just to be a nice guy. And that night, I got drunk, and I wondered whether I should change field, which I didn't. So things have changed. So as Andrea said, I've now moved from Caltech in the West Coast, again to the West Coast, but up the West Coast, 1,200 miles. A number of you asked me about Seattle. Seattle is a fantastic city. You can see it lies on the ocean. It's 4 million people, headquarters of Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing, etc. This is a view from my bedroom. You can see you can see, because one of the fantastic things about Seattle is, so this mountain is Mount Rainier, if you like climbing or mountaineering or rock climbing like me. That's 4,000 meters. It's just straight. You know, you can just drive here in an hour and a half, I'm there. Or if you look at from my living room here outside, you can look at this entire chain here of mountains. They're called the Olympics, and they're between us and the Pacific. So there are mountains everywhere. And you can bike. You don't have to drive. You can bike anywhere. Fantastic place. All right, and that's where the Allen Institute for Brain Science is, because Paul Allen is here. So what are we? We are around roughly 9 years. We're an independent, not-for-profit research organization, and we're really supporting basic research. We're not doing industrial research. We're not doing fee research. It's all basic science. The big thing characteristic about us, whatever we do, we immediately put outside on large-scale curated databases, as Marianne mentioned, and they're freely accessible. You don't have to sign anything. There's no IP, no patents, nothing. So we make these tools and information available for mice, monkey, and human. Right now, I have to edit every time I give this lecture. I have to edit this, because when I came a year ago, we're 150. We're now 200 people and growing rapidly, 45 PhDs. We are across 3 different buildings. We're trying to change that situation. So we're not a traditional PI-driven research institution. So we're not like Genelia Farms, for instance, or the SOC, or not like Caltech or Stanford or Harvard or anything like that. We are much closer to a biotech model. In fact, the original people all came from biotech. So we are project driven. We have large scale projects. I'll talk about one particular project, the one that I'm leading, MindScope. It's and so every year we ask, you know, we have deadlines, we have milestones, we meet with external advisory committees. So it's quite different from a university. We're trying to recruit lots of people, hopefully some of you, and one of the challenges, as you see, is to try to recruit people to tell them to come here rather than to go to Caltech as a professor. And the one difference is we won't let you do any research you want. As I said, we have particular goals, and we want you to help us meet those goals. By the way, we're also not a funding agency. So what we've done in the past, we've generated these high-quality standardized brain-wide atlases. Marianne mentioned several times the mouse brain atlas, which is sort of standard, which expresses all the 22,000 genes using ISH throughout the mouse brain under highly standardized condition, P56, C57, black male mice. We're doing this. We've done the same for the developing mouse, for developing monkey and adult monkey, and we have a large-scale paper coming out next week in Nature where we're doing the same for human, where we have roughly 1,000 different sites where we do microarrays at 1,000 discrete sites in the human brain across 6 brains. Again, all the data is already, way before this paper was ever submitted, all the data is online. You can access it. So from these databases, we have a lot of data. We have 200 million gene expression measurement. We have more petabyte of image data. All right, but we are changing now. So most of the atlas work is finishing off, and we're now embarking on the next decade. So I wrote this article a couple of months ago with Claire Reed, who's joined us from Harvard. And here the relevant point is we laid out a 10-year project to the person who's funded the Institute, Paul Allen, the Microsoft, the person who started with Bill Gates Microsoft. He's given us, for the first 3 years of this project, $300 million. But it's just the first down payment on a decade-long project. So, and we call this MindScope. So Alan Jones, who's a systems biologist is our head, and Claire Riedes joined us from Harvard. He's responsible for neural coding. I'll tell you what that is. Hongqi Zheng, she's responsible for cell type, and Michael Herlovitz, who was here early on, is responsible for modeling, analysis, and theory. So we've recruited a bunch of investigators, and we're trying to recruit more over the next year and a half or 2 years, 20 additional investigators. Right now we have 12 postdocs. We have a large advisory committee. Most of the institute has worked traditionally in, with advisory committees, the chair of which is Marcus Meister, who's now at Caltech. And let's say all of it is made possible by the unprecedented generosity of one particular individual who's deeply interested, with a deep long-term interest in biology. 20% of our funding comes from other sources, NIH or foundation, but the bulk of it comes from Paul Allen. So what are we trying to do? Well, so I'm a physicist, and at Caltech, folks, at Caltech we have a whole range of different telescopes we're building. One of the telescopes we're building is called the TMT, the 30-meter telescope. It's a fantastic instrument. It consists out of almost 500 hexagonal mirrors, which it's going to have a resolution that's roughly 10 times superior. Then it's going to sit on Mount Kea in Hawaii, but still its resolution is 10 times better than the Hubble, which is up in space. The point about this is a very large-scale project. It was first conceived in the opening years of the millennium. First light isn't going to be until 2018, and it's going to cost $1 billion. And already now, there are 200 scientists, technologists, optical people involved in building it. And of course, physics has a tradition of building large-scale instruments like telescopes or like particle accelerator. So we want to do something similar in the neurosciences, particularly for the mouse cortical thalamic system, with methods that are highly standardizable, that are highly reproducible, and that are very accurate, and that we can scale, and that are accessible to anybody. So the vision of this project is we're going to focus enormous resources on the order of 250 plus scientists, engineers, and technicians onto the mammalian cortical thalamic system, particularly sort of we've chosen in the visual system. And the aim of, it, of the broad aim of MindScope over the decade is to discover and understand cortical, the idea, sort of to what extent is there canonical computations, what are the cell types, what is the connectomes. Those are some of our goals. The challenge of this, it's both a technological challenge that you're all well aware of, and then also, Marianne briefly alluded to, a sociological challenge. And you can also think of this as a sort of an experiment in the sociology of neuroscience. Because unlike a university department where you have a bunch of individuals that, you know, typically alpha personality individuals that head off in all possible directions, we're trying to be more than the sum of the individuals. And the question is, you know, will we be successful? So some of our objectives over the next 10 years, sort of we have detailed plans for this with milestone, as I mentioned, every year. We want to characterize all the cell types. We estimate there are roughly 100 different cell types, including the ones coming up from the retina, including the interneurons and the modulatory ones, at the single cell level. So what we'd like to do is to characterize fully the connectome at the cell type level. So in other words, where we know, let's say, layer 5 thick tufted cell has a 20% probability of connecting with other layer 5 thick tufted cell and a 10% probability with connecting with thin tufted with thin cells, and the average amplitude distribution is this, and the it has a time constant of adaptation and the delay is 2 milliseconds. So we like to do these sort of things for all the cell types. So it's not completely at the EM level, it's at the cell level. And then together with Claire Riedes, we'd like to also characterize it at the functional level. In other words, where we know presynaptic, these are, you know, these cells have this orientation, and postsynaptic, we have this orientation, and we understand the detailed connectivity. We like to observe large scale, so in all the 10 different areas, using genetic reporters for all the different cell types in a set of behaviors, in particular sleeping, resting, and behaving mice. We'd like to construct a large-scale simulator and use our structures. So we'll be generating enormous amount of EM data and neuroanatomical data regarding cell type. We like to combine all that information together with connectional data that's already online, our own connectional data that's already online, to model the observed dynamics. So we're going to have, you know, behaving mice. We'll have all the structural data, and we like to have detailed models that connect the structural data with the behaving data. And of course, the modeling's done in-house, and we're also hiring theoretical people in-house, so it's going to be much, much easier to collaborate, because physically, also from the architecture of the building we're designing, we will have, you know, theoretician sitting directly adjacent next to modelers, you know, using the same analysis tool as the experimentalists, so we can freely converse amongst each other. And all of this is going to be made accessible, together with resources like mice, which we already do now, like special silicon probes that we're building. So the mission is, it's primarily based on my interest, is we try to understand, cortex, the 10 different cortical areas, at the level of action perception cycle. So there are many things we're not interested in this project. We're not doing developing, we're not doing long-term potentiations or things like that. We're focusing what happens, you know, when the mouse sees something within a couple of hundred milliseconds or has to make a decision within a couple of hundred milliseconds. And so there are three large groups inside, and they're surrounded, embedded into this matrix of engineering, program management. Any of you who are involved in large-scale projects realize it's absolutely essential to have program management and technology. So there's going to be the cell type project headed by Hong Kui Zheng. So there the challenge is to try to get a complete characterization at the single cell level of all the cell types, including transcriptomics, the complete connectivity, and the electrophysiology. Here, this is experimental neurocoding. This is headed by Claire Reed to do both large-scale two-photon imaging as well as large-scale electrophysiology in genetic and identified cell population in the cortical thalamic system. And then here, the challenge is both to model that in detail as well as to analyze this data and develop new analysis tool using machine learning and other techniques, as well as to understand this from a theoretical point of view. And so the broad question is, you know, how do 2 million neurons roughly, if you guesstimate, so that they're on the order of 2 million neurons in the system, if you include the tectum, and the various thalamic nucleus, et cetera. So what we're doing, these five components, we want to exhaustively describe the system. We'd like to sort of quantify things. One of our patron saints, I'll show you a picture later on, is the Count von Count. Very famous person. He likes to count cookies, but he also likes to count cell-type synapses. We like to record, as I mentioned. We like to interfere using various optogenetic tools so we can, you know, make specific prediction and knock out very specific connections like the layer 6 to thalamic connections while the mouse is behaving. We like to model, and finally, we like to understand it. Well, we, of course, you need to use theoretical understanding, not just computer models. Why is this difficult? Well, you know there are lots of neurons. It's difficult to simultaneously record for more than a tiny fraction of them. We don't have a list of cellular components, right? We know there are interneurons in pyramidal cell and there are spiny stellates, but it's only over the last 10 years that we've realized in the retina alone there are 60 discrete cell types. So the question is, to what extent are there discrete cell types in the cortex in the thalamus? How many different are there? How different are they? And then to exhaustively characterize them all. We have, and this is, keeps on being very shocking for me, there are no accepted standards for relevant phenomena. So if you talk about things like oscillation, synchrony, synphide chain, sharp waves, there's no accepted terminology. In fact, even for things like action potential, there's no accepted definition of what an action potential is. At some point at Caltech, there were seven groups, each group of them being Caltech nerds, wrote their own spike detection and discrimination software, and each, of course, passionately believed that theirs was the optimal, and the other ones were doing it incorrectly. People are more likely to share each other toothbrush than to share each other algorithm, which is really very bad for data sharing. It leads to the fact that you have very often data sets that can't be reconciled, similar to the problem that she mentioned, that Marianne mentioned with ontologies. There are no central unifying projects. And in fact, all of you have been to neuroscience. It's always an amazing experience, like being on drugs. You have on the order of 10,000 labs. There are roughly 60,000 neuroscientists right now worldwide. They are organized on the order of 10,000 labs. And they are sort of exploding in this profusion. It's like this, it's like a big bang, right? That if you just go past posters, you see a variety of people doing any possible animal in every possible developmental stage, using every possible technique, using different algorithms, different hardware, different analysis tools, And in fact, our university system is designed to promote this, because our entire research effort, which has been spectacularly successful, our entire research effort has been designed to be to maximize orthogonality, right? You only get a PhD, you only get tenure, you only get a Nature paper, you only get an NIH grant if you're doing things that are maximally different from what your predecessor or your colleague is doing. Because otherwise people will think, well, you know, this is something very similar to what somebody else has already done and we don't want to fund that. You can convince your own student to do an experiment. If somebody has done it already, let's say in a layer 2-3, then nobody's going to do it in layer 4, because if the layer 2-3 led to a Nature paper, the layer 4 paper will maybe, you know, make it in JNU Science, and the layer 5 analysis will make it into the supplementary material, right? And so you can't do it. Now that's great if you want to pop, if you want to pop it in the early romantic phase of a field, which sort of we were over the last 60 years, where you want to populate and understand sort of episodes and just sort of understand the lay of the land. But if you want to do things now more systematically, it just doesn't work in this way. And so it's simply universities are simply not set up for these large-scale systematic efforts. This is no news if you talk to physics people, you know, LHC and other large accelerators. And of course, there's a limited interaction between experiments, models, and theories. So we'd like to change that. We've picked, I'm going to skip some of these slides. We've picked neocortex for obvious reasons. I don't need to tell you. We study the mouse, A, because it has a smooth cortex so we can observe, B, because it's a genetic model organism, and now with help of CHAM rhodopsin, helorhodopsin, ARCH, etc., we can intervene at any given point in time, space, and in a given neuronal population. And that's one of the reasons I'm here now. I'm not studying human consciousness anymore, but I'm interested in consciousness in these creatures. And with the human brain, by and large, it's look but not touch. You cannot intervene, right? You can do techniques like TMS, but they're very crude. They involve very large populations of cells. And in order to understand any phenomena, in particular phenomena such as attention and consciousness, you really need to understand the level of individual groups of neurons. You know, atoms, if you want to understand chemistry, you need to know about atoms and outer, you know, valence electrodes. If you want to understand consciousness, memory, perception, you need to understand about large-scale groups of neurons interacting with each other. All right, these are the dimensions. So the mouse is roughly 1,000 times smaller than in terms of the brain, in terms of its weight, in terms of the number of neurons, in terms of the number of neurons in the visual system. In terms of the area of cortex, it's roughly, you know, it's roughly a sugar cube, 1 cubic centimeter versus roughly 1 liter. So it's, you know, 10, 10, 10, factor 10 linear, factor 1,000 in volumes. So as I said, we're dealing with a couple of million neurons. There are a million axons in the optic nerve. Here, in our case, there are 40,000 roughly. That, you know, 30 plus areas here in the mouse. There are 10 visual areas. It's slightly different. It has the cone system. It's a dichromat, and interestingly, it has a cone in the UV. Almost every single paper, in fact, I only know one paper or two papers that looked at here. Almost every paper you've ever seen on the mouse uses green light. Actually, it turns out the response, both the behavioral response and the evoked retinal response, is much bigger to UV light. Interesting mystery. Now mice, they can perfectly well see, of course. You can make it, this is a nice paper from Mark Heistad. You know, this is a tuning curve, just like in a human or in a monkey, but notice the peak here. The peak is at 0.1 cycle per degree. So it's, you know, maybe 50 times worse. So it's not, we're not talking about a high resolution system, and of course they don't even have a fovea. So it's not a scaled down in terms of the visual system itself, the retina, it's not a scaled down version of a in terms of the geometry of a human or macaque. It sees much, much less. It roughly sees as well as you do at 15 degrees eccentricity. You know, if I fixate here, it roughly sees as well as I see out here. The great thing is you can put a single chamber, you know, 5 millimeter over its back brain, and then you can see in a single chamber, you can observe the entire visual system. So this is 1 millimeter. This is V1. These are 9 adjoining areas. There's a topography is shown by these injections here. So that's a big advantage. In a single observation, you can, in principle, observe all the neurons in the visual system, in the cortical visual system. What we have already, we have ongoing, there's already data online. We're doing this large-scale connectional atlas in the mouse, where we inject 350 different brain regions using 100 Cre driver lines and combined with AAV virus. And then we reconstruct the entire brain of the mouse, so you can see. So we get an understanding of the detailed connection at the level of discrete population. So it started a year and a half. It's going to be over next year. Some of the data is already online. So for example, here we can sort of, you can see, so this is an injection into visual cortex. Lateral resolution is 0.35 micrometers. So you can go through the various parts of the brain. You can see discrete. You can see this connectional database. So one of the advantages you can take, for example, you can take the classical David von Essen-Fellman hierarchy, and here what you can do, you can adopt it for the mouse. These are the various 10 visual areas, and now you can actually weight these links. You can weight them by actual numbers. So it's not just you know, here's a connection of unknown strengths between two visual areas, but you can actually estimate how. The strengths, and now with this new data, soon we'll be able to estimate the discrete strengths to discrete subpopulation within these pathways. As I said, we know this from the retina. There's roughly 60 different cell types in all mammae, in fact, in all vertebrate retinas. And so the question is, to what extent is this also going to be true in cortex? To what extent, for example, does tiling hold? In other words, to what extent is it true that each cell type is expressed, you know, in a mosaic form across entire visual cortex? That's not known right now. So we are putting a lot of resources into developing viral techniques and using a whole bunch of different technologies to try to get an exhaustive pictures of all the cell types. Well, we'd like to get a complete census of all cells, similar to what Marcel Oberländer is doing, but we're trying to do it in the visual system. We like to establish technologies that we can then pipeline. So what we are always doing, we're trying to establish a technology and pioneer it or adapt it from somebody from outside, and then try to get it work in one area in one cell type, and then pipeline it. In other words, then you set up 6 microscopes or 10 microscopes, and you do the same project throughout all the different cell types in all the different areas under the same standard operating procedure, same conditions. So you get a very nice, very homogeneous data set that you can then put out and curate. We'd like to do a 3D reconstruction of the complete 3D morphology, both the dendrites and the proximal axons, as well as the distal axons. We're now doing this full panel characterization of physiological and synaptic properties. We are doing the transcriptomics now. We're right now doing sort of proof of principle studies where we link single cell gene expressions on each individual neuron. We do this together with Ed Boyden at MIT, where for each individual cell, we characterize a subset of their genes that we think are particularly relevant for synaptic properties and for the physiology, and link them with the electrophysiological behavior and the morphological behavior, something similar to what Henry Markham is doing. And as I said, we are working to get these cell types specific and connectome. And we're going to put all this online. With Clay Reed, we're trying to exhaustively characterize for a set of standard stimuli the response property of genetic identified cell into the inputs, the LGN and V1, and then throughout the other visual areas. By the way, but when I mean visual areas, of course, we know visual cortex is not in isolation. There are other areas there, and so we have to be flexible to go, and we will go into motor structures or possibly go into subcortical structures. As I said, the big advantage is you can put a single chamber, 5 millimeter over the visual system, and you can capture most of it. So this is a nice study, an early classical study by Chris Neal and Mike Stryker, finding beautiful tuned receptive field just like in cat or monkey, with one difference. That, and in fact, Tommy Poggio remarked upon this. So you can see here that it's very similar, the receptive field. They do have orientation tuning, except this is roughly 1 degree, and this is roughly 20 degrees. So mouse vision, it's a real visual system, but it's less high fidelity than a monkey. So we know already something about the inter-areal functional connectivity in mouse visual cortex, something that's been very, very difficult to do in monkey. In fact, I only know one study like this between V1 and MT. So this is a study from Clay's lab when he was still at Harvard, where he used various standardized spatial temporal frequency, and then you can explore some of the different areas. So you do this in V1, and then you explore some of these other areas. Think of them like V2, V3, V4. They have different labels. And this is temporal sensitivity, spatial sensitivity. So you can understand there are these different projection and there are different receptive fields in these different areas that have different spatial temporal property. This is something very similar. It's a related study. Both came out back to back in Neuron. This is from Ed Calloway's study lab at the SOG doing something similar. So he does it for V1 and the other areas. Here he plots the mean orientation selectivity, direction selectivity, the preferred spatial frequency and temporal frequency. So the nice thing is you can characterize the behavior quite nicely. Now this is not done, so this is done using GChem3, but not with a particular promoter. Of course, in principle now you can do the same thing. That's one of the things we'd like to do. You do this for all the different cell types. So you ask the question, what's the tuning, for example, of interneuron, or what's the tuning of layer 2, 3 versus layer 5? And in principle, you can do that in all the different areas so that you really get a high quality, complete coverage and understanding of the receptive field properties of every cell in visual cortex. And then, of course, what Clay wants to do, he did this, last year had a very beautiful paper in Nature where he did, in cortex, where he functionally identified using two photon calcium imaging the tuning properties of a certain piece in one mouse of a particular piece of cortex, and then cut that up and did EM reconstruction at the electron microscopic level, where you can directly connect at the EM level, where you can relate the functional property with the structural property. So we're also going to do that in visual cortex, sort of to get ultimately ground zero. Yeah, and then we will use, so the standard stimuli, we'll use sort of these sort of wavelet stimuli, and then we'll also use natural stimuli, using a standard stimuli, where you have a mouse running on a trackball and where you can use more natural stimuli. We're working now together with, so I've been always interested over the last 20 years, I've worked a lot with Gary Buzaki on this, trying to understand the properties of local fields and the properties of inter and extracellular recordings. I gave a talk about this a couple of days ago, and I've been frustrated by the fact that the circuit technology in our computers is probably two orders of magnitude better, or in our iPhones, is probably two orders of magnitude better than the circuit technology used in microelectrodes. So there's this project that's being initiated by Tim Harris at Genelia Farm and partly supported by us and a few other large organizations. It's not inexpensive to work together with IMEC, the Belgian silicon foundry, to build very high density probes, 10 millimeter long. This is the noise characteristics for 20 microvolt for a local field, under 5 for action potential, to have 500 electrodes. Which you can choose in real time. So in other words, you have this piece of 10 millimeter silicon that's 20 meter thin only, 20 micrometers, quite nice, where you have 500 sides or maybe 1,000 sides, but you select 64, but then you amplify them and you mux them, right? So that's a cool thing. So in other words, rather than having 1,000 wires going out, you have maybe 4 wires going out, and you can switch in real time. And once these are fabricated and tested, they'll be made available to the community. Because, I mean, what I'd like to do, I'd like to record, there's no reason within a couple of years we should not be able to record from every single cell in a column. If you look at advanced circuit technology like your latest Intel, that's 14 nanometer pitch. Right? The current pitch on our microelectrodes, the ones you can commercially buy, are 2 or 3 micrometer. Right? So we're essentially 20 years behind. There's no reason why we can't build enough electronics on pattern piece of silicon that we can record from every single cell in a mini column. All right, one of the big things we're doing, in fact, we've done this over the past 3 years. Now our mice are sort of the second and third most popular mice that people download from Jackson's lab. We've built a whole set of engineered mice, and because we have the advantage, we have models and theory, work very close with the experimentalists, we can make mice that test specific theories, like something that Giulio Tononi and Francis Crick and I have written quite a bit about, for example, the specific importance of cortical or cortical thalamic feedback, that we can inactivate them and test them in behaving mice. We'll have this is the count, for those of you who don't know. He counts cookies, but he also counts neurons and synapses, and he insists on numerical accuracy. He's not going to let us get away with slaw. We're going to use a standard coordinate system, so in order that we know, both for the slice experiments as well as for the in vivo animal, behaving animal experiment, that across different platforms, across electrophysiology, across two-photon calcium imaging, across all the slice experiments, we know always within 20 micrometer where we are. So we can always know within our atlas where are we, and you know, because there will be gradients, you know, medial, dorsal, temporal, anterior, posterior gradient. So it's really important in order to have high quality, high reproducible data to know exactly where you are. Then we have this modeling component where we are going to start off with relatively simple models. So unlike Henry, with whom we collaborate, but Henry Markham, we're not immediately going to start off doing a detailed biophysical model of the entire visual brain. I don't think that's right now feasible. We're going to do detailed biophysical model of parts of it, like the column. But we're going to model the entire thing using sort of adapting existing, like of Marcus Diestmann, adapting existing large-scale models, but simply integrating fine model, but now matched against our own physiology, our own in vivo and in vitro data. We're working with Google. They're next door. They have a very large lab, 1,400 engineers just next to us. And we're working with them something they call Big Brain, which is essentially to build a free, open source, cross platform, so you can do it on Linux, PC, Mac, web-based cross platform collaboration and simulation environment, where any multi-users can log in. It's going to be all publicly accessible, where you can download the data and download our model and download our data. So if you don't trust our papers, well, here's the data, here's the model, you can run it yourself. And you can either run it, if you are prepared to wait a long time, you can run it on your laptop, or you can run it on a supercomputer, or you can run it through the cloud, the Amazon or Google Cloud. So this is going to be a cool thing that allows people to directly replicate. Because I've been involved in large-scale modeling, particularly on supercomputers, and it's very difficult to actually replicate it, because you always have to go through the supercomputer, and you have to write the code, which is highly specialized, and it's a pain in the neck using Nest. So the models, we have a series of models. So as I said, we're not immediately going to start out doing a large-scale model. We'll start simple to make models that where we can match the spiking behavior against the various cell types, and then use our own connectivity to model our own physiology. So that's a great thing about having high quality data that's taken under very standard conditions. That becomes much easier to model. We will also do these very detailed models. So this is a model that involves 12,000 cells. Each one has 600 compartments to do things like local field. But it's not going to be of the entire brain. It's going to be just of small pieces of it. So to finish, these are plans for large scale compared to the Stanford University lab. Large scale, high throughput, 10 years plus effort that come with some unique challenges. So our ambition is not to be a world-class neurobiology department. There are many of those, one of them where I came from at Caltech, and they're doing fine. But what we want to be something different, where we have world-class individuals that do world-class research and publish their own paper. So people always ask me, there have been already, and there are two sorts of papers we publish. One is the large platform papers, like this paper coming out next week in Nature, where there's 60 authors that, 50 of them worked for the past 4 years on this very large-scale human brain atlas project. But then there are also many projects where there are just two or three people that publish. Somebody like Clay Reed, and you join Clay Reed as a postdoc, you publish a paper with him on doing something, some cool whiz bang, viral technology combined with two-photon imaging. But then we want to take this or some of these cool experiments and then run them in a large pipeline, high throughput. So what's really important that we are more than the sum of the parts. So we're really, and this is what keeps me awake at night, how can we enable synergy? How we can get these different people from, physicists and computer scientists and virologists and biochemists and molecular biologists and physiologists to work together every single day. So one of the challenges which we're doing now, which we're pretty confident we can meet, is just set up state-of-the-art observatories. But then we have to do this tight integration of data acquisition, theory, and model, and then do this virtual loop. So it's going to take some time. And as I said, we are not a university, so we don't have tenure. If you come, we're not going to tell you, okay, here you get 2,000 square feet of space and you're going to get $1.5 million, and that's just your money and you can do with it what you want. I mean, that's a typical what happens, you know, if you join a university department. So instead we're going to tell you, you know, we have these common goals and you have, you know, we are looking for people to help us, you know, think of some cool experiments, you know, but in the context of our overall goal. And that sort of requires a different mentality and a different personality. As I said, you can think of it as an experiment in sociology of neuroscience. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
So thank you. I think this is a fantastic project, and which I think will be very, very important. And I think many of us sort of have been, or this is like many of us have been thinking this is the way you have to do it, more like a comprehensive approach. But not everyone can move to Seattle, and there might be other groups who would like to participate in this or collaborate or to get into this. So do you have any like plans how to do that, or?
Well, so in the past we've collaborated with many external people. We've worked with many external people. They're collaborators, but so we thought a lot about the problem that, for example, Marianne is facing at NIF. To what extent do we incorporate other people's data into our own database? Right, for instance, right now we've not done that just because we want to be sure it's exactly the same strain, you know, it's the same mice, it's the same operating condition that we use. So if you give us, for example, spiking data, we don't know to what extent it's similar or different from our spiking data. And so by and large, we've made the decision that most of the data and most of the experiments will be done in-house. But we're more than, I mean, yeah, we're happy. We collaborate with Sean Hill, with INCF, because all of this is supposed to be open. We have all these advisory committee. You can even see what they recommend. All of that is online.
Further question. Well, I've one myself. How will theory, as opposed to modeling, be incorporated? What kind of platforms, what kind of interactions do you plan?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. So we have interviewed, we just made two offers. I think they're both going to come. So again, we'd like, you know, so we, for example, if you think about attractor models, right? So people, you know, even at this meeting have attractor models. Well, so the idea is, let's think about attractor models, but in the context of a visual behavior that we can actually test in a mouse, where you have a theoretician who works maybe together with a modeler, you know, who does the detailed modeling. So once again, it has to be within the context rather than doing some very abstract model that applies for, you know, mainly for humans or for C. elegans. It has to be something that we can directly take and try to understand and test in our observatories, in our systems.
Including things like in Santa Barbara, that we have large-scale workshops where you bring in a number of people for an extended period of time, or what's the framework?
Yeah, so what we thought, once this is all up and running, we'll have a fellows program where just like in a telescope, either at the ITP in Santa Barbara or like when you go, you know, for example, at a modern telescope, you apply to a committee to get observational time, right? So the idea is once it's up and running, and let's say somebody here who has, you know, an olfactory system, that once we're up and running, we're envisioning it would be nice to get people who do come for a year to make use of these, you know, we'll have trained technicians, we'll have all these setups, but then sort of do something, let's say, olfactory, or do an auditory task. Try to see to what extent what we learn from the visual system, doing a visual discrimination, what happens if we do an auditory discrimination, so that people can come and test these things.
Great. Yeah. Hi. My question is related to Gauta's question in that you could ask the same question for modelers, right? And you might be more hesitant to incorporate experimental data, but you could reproduce every single spiking model in the world in your computers. Is there any plan to do something like that?
No, because there are hundreds of them.
Well, hundreds is not very many, right?
Well, because each one has to be written and programmed and tested. But listen, all the data is going to be there. So if you wanted to come, or if you want to download every single last spike, right? So, you know, and model it and do use all of our data, anybody's free to do it. It's all, the, I mean, once we have it, all the data is going to be there before we publish anything. So, but we cannot possibly test every possible model. I mean, that's not, also that's not our interest. We have some specific, I have some specific idea. Some of my colleagues have some specific idea how the visual system works, and we're not going to test every possible model.
But going forward, you could, if you dominated, if you created a standard like Nest, for example.
Well, then I mean, if you have a particular model that you want to test, then just join us. Write a letter to us. We'll host you as a fellow or something, and then you can test your particular ideas. As again, as Mary Ann emphasized, you know, we have some particular ideas. You know, partly because, you know, I'm a product of, you know, my particular age and thinking, and so I can't imagine all the possible models that other people will have, but and that's for them to test. In this way, you need people who are passionate about some particular idea, and will want to go out and test it. Just like I'm passionate about the idea about consciousness and testing that.
Okay, further questions? If not, then let's thank Christoph a lot for this talk. Thank you. And